Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has called for changes in the way colleges and universities deal with sexual misconduct allegations. She wants more protections for the accused in the investigation process. GLT's Eric Stock talks with ISU Title IX coordinator Tony Walesby about those proposals. Walesby says there could be some changes coming out of the proposed regulations.
Right now, our process includes more what's called the single investigator model. That includes that the investigator will take the allegation of sexual misconduct, investigate it through its conclusion, and then reach a determination. The current regulations somewhat do away from that single investigator model, and so we're trying to figure out what exactly that might look like on our campus. For example, we currently embed a live hearing model in our process. The new regulations call for that, but they also call for a different person than the investigator to make the findings. And so we're currently figuring out on our campus what that might look like.
Would that dramatically change the process then, in your view? Would that provide more protection for the accused? Because that seems to be the foundation on which these new guidelines are built.
You know, it's hard to say what ultimately the impact would be. Certainly, one of the biggest changes that's proposed right now is the direct cross-examination of both parties. So currently, let's say that you are accused of sexual misconduct and you have a question for the person who's accused you, then you would ask the hearing officer, I have a question for this person. The hearing officer would determine if that's an appropriate question, and then the hearing officer would ask that of the aggrieved party or their survivor. Under the new proposed regulations, they can talk back and forth, including their support person. So you could have the attorney for, let's say, the respondent, the person who's been accused, directly asking questions of the aggrieved party. So that's a bit different than the process that we currently have.
Is there a concern that under that format, some victims could be deterred from coming forward, that the lens would be turned on to them, so to speak?
We are always concerned and worried that any of our students, those who are coming forward and those who are accused, will not feel that they're getting support throughout the process, that they're concerned about the process. So you may have noticed that we are doing a variety of training and outreach across campus. We want our students who are coming forward, again, as well as we've always wanted our students who are accused of these things to feel like it's a very fair process, a very thorough process. Even if you don't directly ask a question of the other party, then we would certainly do that, right? We never want any of our students to feel like we've predetermined what the finding will be, that we're in any way biased against any person. We just want folks to come forward, conduct a very fair and thorough investigation, and then we reach a finding based on the evidence that's provided.
Do you believe that these changes to the Title IX law that are being proposed, narrowing the definition of sexual harassment, could that make it harder to punish perpetrators?
I'm curious to see how it'll all play itself out. And of course, we have our Illinois Preventing Sexual Violence Act that was passed in 2015. And so that plays a part here. There are changing definitions, as you know, with the proposed regulations. Certainly the definition of sexual harassment, as you alluded to. Also, the proposed regulations also talk about sexual misconduct that's occurring within a program, service, or activity of the university. And so, for example, currently we investigate allegations of sexual assault, sexual misconduct that occur off campus in an off campus apartment involving our students. The question will be now moving forward, well, that's not really a program, service, or activity, but the university would still have an interest in that, perhaps. And so, again, we're kind of trying to figure out on our end, one, what the final regulations will be, two, how does that relate to our state law, and then three, how do we best do all of this with respect to our students in mind, making sure all of our students, again, who are involved in this process are equally supported.
And could the new rules lighten the pressure on college campuses to investigate claims of misconduct, either by students or by faculty or staff?
You know, I graduated from here in 1991, and since that time, I've done nothing but investigate allegations of civil rights violations. And so I've been doing it in higher ed for about 20 years now. So I've never felt like a pressure from the government. It's always been, at least in my mind, there's a serious allegation that's raised. We have university policy that relate to the allegation, and let's conduct that very fair and thorough investigation to find out what's going on. And so I hope that universities across the country will view the new regulations and say, okay, here is the government's right to make changes. The courts will also help inform what all this means. And in the end, universities are stepping back to make sure, okay, we are, one, compliant with all federal and any applicable state laws, and two, we're doing what's in the best interest of our students.
We're visiting with Tony Walesby, who is the director of the Office for Equal Opportunity and Access at Illinois State University, as we discuss new guidelines proposed by the Department of Education at the federal level that would address sexual harassment on college campuses in perhaps a different light. Would these new changes possibly disrupt that balance?
So I would say that we definitely think that the appropriate checks and balances are in place. So, for example, currently the Title IX investigator will draft a finding. They will share that with me as the Title IX coordinator. And I'll have to agree with it. I can have questions. Well, let's follow up with this, those kind of things. And so we have some checks and balances built within the process. I think the biggest proposed change would be that hearing itself will take place, but then the investigator steps back and someone else steps in to make a determination. And so that then will require that other person coming in to really kind of immerse themselves in the case, understanding credibility assessments, understanding all the evidence that's being presented, and then reach a conclusion.
Can that be a problem? Why might that be a problem, or is it not a problem?
You know, I think it will depend on several factors, you know, including, again, the person who's kind of taking that all in will really need to, again, kind of immerse themselves into the case. For someone who's been investigating it, let's say you've had the case for a month, you're really living in that case in terms of, I understand the allegations that are made, I understand the response, I spoken to 3 or 4 witnesses, 20 witnesses, whatever it is, you're really kind of understanding that case. It's certainly possible to convey all of that to another person, and so that's what we'll have to do. We'll have to devise a way by which we can share all of the information with the person making the determination so that they feel comfortable reaching the determination that they'll make.
And who would this outside person be, and who would appoint them?
We're still working on that. We're still trying to figure out, would that be someone who is connected into our office, but a different investigator? Would that be someone within student affairs? Would that be somebody outside? We don't know yet.
What do you believe the genesis of these policy changes are?
You know, I think that I used to be a federal investigator, and so I think that the government is always interested in looking at processes, making sure that all students are equally protected, which I think is a good thing. And so we've had several, these Dear Colleague letters that are most known in this area starting in 2011. Really, Dear Colleague letters have been happening for many decades. It's the government's way of communicating to universities and to K-12 districts what they expect in terms of civil rights enforcement. And so this is just a continuation of that process.
And we've heard in some corners, especially during Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation process, that the Me Too movement has become so emboldened by our desire to believe the victim that it can become too easy to ruin someone's life by simply raising the allegation and coming up with a story that no one is really able to refute. How much of a concern is that as someone who is seeking equal opportunity for all, and does that play a part in this?
Sure. I mean, as I tell folks when they come to us, they ask the same thing. You know, I have a concern, but no one else is in the room, and so I'm concerned that no one will believe me. And what we tell everybody is that what we're focused in on is the evidence that's being presented, right? And so we have some cases for which the evidence doesn't support a finding. We have other cases for which it does support the finding. It's really not about how individually the investigator or the Title IX coordinator or anybody feels about the case. It's that this is what the evidence looks like. You can imagine writing those final reports. You have to have some reasonable basis by which to reach a conclusion. We presume, the new regulations call for this, but we've always done this. We presume the person who's being accused did not do it, unless there's compelling evidence to support that they did. And so when we look at that evidence, we say, okay, here's this very serious allegation, and here's that person's response. In addition to that, what other evidence is available? Weighing it all together, is there a preponderance of the evidence? Is there 50.1% evidentiary standard showing that there's a violation or not?
So that is the civil lawsuit threshold, basically.
That's
not
exactly
the
right.
beyond a reasonable doubt then.
That's right. So if you think of the evidentiary standards, we know beyond reasonable doubt in a criminal, in a court. We have clear and convincing, which is the next one, and then we have preponderance of the evidence. For civil rights laws, it's always been preponderance of the evidence. That's what we've used as the basis. The government and courts have guided us. Under the proposed regulations, it does allow a university to use clear and convincing, that next standard above for these cases. However, for universities within the state of Illinois, it's somewhat academic because our state law requires preponderance of the evidence to be used.
Is that a fair enough threshold?
You know, so coming into my 28th year, it's the only one I've ever used. Hmm. And so I would say yes. You know, again, but to your point earlier, we take these very seriously because we know if a person's found responsible for sexual misconduct, that could impact their career choices, right? If you want to be a police officer, if you want to be an attorney, there are background checks, right? And so we don't enter into these lightly. If we're making a finding of sexual misconduct, that is serious, and we take it serious. And so to the points with the Me Too movement and others, absolutely. When someone comes forward, we want them to have all the support services that are available to them. We want them to be able to go to class, be able to live in their residence hall and feel safe. Our role then as neutral fact finders is to determine, does the evidence support the allegations while we're still absolutely supporting all of our students?
It appears one challenge when you're dealing with the evidence in determining guilt or innocence, so to speak, is a lot of that evidence is circumstantial, and it could be next to impossible to really to get to the truth of the matter. It becomes a, quote, he said, she said.
I mean, oftentimes, especially with our students nowadays, again, when I first started this, there was really no cell phones or internet. I mean, there wasn't much of that. But when our students are in a room, sometimes there's another person in the room, but oftentimes not, but on occasion there is. We'll have situations where the students will leave the room, and then they'll start to describe to their friends what their version of events happened. Now, that's their version of events, and so that's important to us. But we still have to weigh all of the evidence to determine, okay, I believe in the room this occurred, the other person believes the opposite. A lot of these cases get down to the issue of consent. Oftentimes, but not always, oftentimes there is a consensual interaction between the two parties. Something is happening for which both parties are okay with, and then there's an escalation. And then the question is, was the escalation, was it reasonably known to the person who's escalating that they can do that? Did they have consent to do the next act for which they're escalating? And that's often with these cases. Now, sometimes it's not. Sometimes, you know, it's stalking case, it's domestic violence. We have a variety of types of cases. For the sexual assault cases, it could be a person who they do not know. It also could be a person for which they're interacting and they know. But what was consensual and what was agreed upon or what wasn't consensual?
Title IX Coordinator Tony Walesby of Illinois State University says whatever changes happen is that students continue to feel comfortable coming forward. Walesby was talking with GLT's Eric Stock. Walesby says in many universities, about 30% of the allegations are ruled to have cause, but in Title VII Civil Rights Act cases, which cover sexual harassment in businesses, he says the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission cause rate is about 3 to 5%.